at all you shiny people. Should be interesting tonight. I get emotional when I tell my story anyway, and I was sedated for a medical procedure a few days ago, and the sedation, I was weeping during John Wick yesterday, so this could go any which of a way. All right. It's great to see a room full of folks. You guys made it through your first Christmas. Now you've got some first-hand experience. You can do that. That's badass. You know, like my phone has been ringing off the hook since Christmas evening, going, dude, what do I do? How do I get in? You know. So, but you don't, none of you guys has to make that phone call ever again if you don't want to. You know, it's my belief based on my experience that every single person in this room can stay sober from now until the day you die. I absolutely believe that. So my name's Chris Gates. I'm an addict and alcoholic. What that means is I'm a low bottom heroin addict and a binge drinker. And I've been sober since October 5th of 1998. And nobody's more surprised about that than me. You know, you guys know me. My take on the steps is a little different than a lot of folks. I'm a little Asperger's-y, and I tend to be a systems analyst. Like, I take everything apart and put it back together since I was a little kid. And my entire time in sobriety has been spent throwing away the crap that doesn't make any sense that people say in meetings and trying to get down to what am I supposed to be doing? You know, because recovery is supposed to be a practical plan for living, not a practical faith for believing. And so I want to know what my job is. So my story, it's a little different than a lot of folks in that there's no alcoholism in my family, really, till this generation. You know, neither side of my family drinks. You know, my mom's side doesn't drink at all. But on my mom's side of the family, there is a history of what I now know as spiritual malady and suicide. Because if you grow up in a culture where you have the kind of spiritual malady I had, and there's no drugs or alcohol to treat that, eventually you kill yourself, I think. You know, but I grew up in a very happy family, loving and supportive and wonderful. My parents were actually together until my mom died, and my dad was married to my stepmom for 28 years. You know, like, those are my people. And I was a real happy little kid until the first day of first grade. And then I went to school, and those kids, I didn't know them, and they made me nervous, and they made me uncomfortable. And so I came home, and I started to eat, because food was my first drug of choice. Yeah, it's funny. You could talk about accidentally running over a child while you were drunk in an AA meeting, and people will feel for you. But you start talking about food, and people get real fucking quiet. But so I started eating. And then at 7 years old, I saw the Rolling Stones on Ed Sullivan in 1968 and knew from that moment I wanted to play guitar in a rock band. That was my future. I knew it beyond a shadow of a doubt. You know, within a year and a half, I had mowed enough yards to buy a really terrible guitar, and I was listening, and I grew up right by the UT campus in the late 60s. So there's hippies everywhere, and, you know, I'm mowing yards and going to their garage sales and buying their albums. I don't even know what the records are. Cover's interesting. I'll go home and listen to it. And just all about music. And then we moved about half a mile between sixth grade and seventh grade, and it put me in a different district. So everybody from my grade school, who I had failed to develop real friendships with anyway, because that's how I roll, went to a different middle school. And I went to this middle school out in North Austin. And everybody in middle school feels weird and different. Like, the head cheerleader feels left out on the wrong day. But, and you know, I've got twin girls who are 21 now, and I know middle school is a holding pin for complete hormonal lunacy. But I was different than those kids. You know, it's 1972, and I got hair down to here, and I'm walking around with a mono tape deck and an earphone listening to Black Sabbath, and they haven't even discovered the radio yet. And I also start going to concerts by myself, because at 12 years old, nobody I know wants to go. So my parents just drop me off, and I go by myself. And startlingly, there's a lot of marijuana smoking in those concerts in 1973. And in the beginning, it was weird. I didn't know what was, you know, they're passing joints, and I'm going, oh, I don't know what that's about, whatever, I'm 12, you know. But they seem like nice people. And by the third or fourth concert, I start trying it. And, you know, and then it turns out, not surprisingly, that there's a guy who sells pot about two blocks from my house. And so middle school was all about marijuana and food, because those go well together. And, you know, and I'm going to concerts, and I'm listening to music, and I'm hanging out in my room, and and staying stoned. I'm a good student. I used to be like very, I used to be really smart. I could say that now. It's not bragging because it's not true anymore. But the drugs and the alcohol have sanded the edges off of a lot of my thinking. And then I get to high school, and by the time I'm in ninth grade, I'm 6 feet tall. I weigh 205 pounds. I have hair down to here and a beard. And the drinking age is 18. So getting alcohol around the campus is also not an issue. So I start drinking and smoking weed and, you know, and the music. And I know some people whose story is alcoholic drinking and using from the right out of the gate. But that's not my story. Like, drugs and alcohol worked really, really good for a long time. You know, they did the thing I needed them to do. They made me able to talk to people and to feel connected to people. And they made me able to relax and enjoy myself. And they worked great for years. And then for a while, they were still working, but there was more and more consequences. And then for a while, they didn't help no matter how much I did, and I kept overdosing, and then I got sober. But at this point, things are still working. I graduate high school, and within 3 months of graduating high school, my hair is this long and bleach blonde, and I'm in a punk band. I'm in my first real band. I'm in college, too. You know, wasn't like if you go to college or even when you go to college. It was when you go to UT, so okay. And so I went, and by the kind of student I was, like, I took 6 years of college math in high school because I liked math and it was easy for me, but I never took any math in college because I couldn't figure out where they held the placement test. And I smoked a lot of pot. So I'm playing music, and it's going well. The band is doing well. People like us. And there are some people hanging around that scene that are doing a lot of speed. And they kind of freak me out. But most everybody's just drinking, smoking a bunch of weed. It's all fine. Now, I have a history of depression, too. I had a suicide attempt in high school. And then I had a breakdown when I was 21 and was locked up in Shoal Creek for a week. They thought I was trying to kill myself. I don't know. I don't really remember anything about it. And I got put on antidepressants for the first time and stopped drinking and using without making a decision for 6 months. And then I turned 22 and I fell off my parents' insurance and couldn't get the meds anymore. And within 6 months, I was drinking so much that I would pass out. I never blacked out. I passed out. And my friends liked me, but there was no getting my big deadweight ass back to the car. So they'd roll me onto my stomach so I didn't pull a Hendrix and leave me wherever I fell. And I would wake up in alleys or front yards or whatever I'd come to. And my solution to that was never to wonder if maybe I should slow down on drinking. I just got to pal up with the guys doing all the speed because they weren't bad guys. I knew a lot of them by now. You know, and some of those guys were using needles and they freaked me out. But I got to know them. They weren't bad guys. You know, the first band I'm in does well. We make a bunch of records. We tour around the country. When that band falls apart, the next band I get in, our motto is show up drunk, show up late, don't show up at all. And by this point, I'm dealing meth like you do. And just roaring through a couple of years. That band made a couple of records, did a few tours. We were way more popular in other cities. People didn't like us in Austin very much. And I went on tour to Southern California, and I stayed after the band came back to Austin. And I ran into some friends of mine who I knew from their punk band, and they took me to this party. They had a new band, and it was more of a rock and roll thing. And so I went to this party with them, and their band played their first show, and the second band on the bill was a band called Faster Pussycat playing their first show, and the third band on the bill was Guns N' Roses at their fifth show in a room smaller than this in a basement of an apartment complex. And I went, I want to be in a rock band. So I came back to Texas, and I packed up my shit, and I left, moved to L.A. I had some friends that owned a store out there, and they hired me to print T-shirts for them, and so I just went. You know, my L.A. years was like recreating middle school. Like, I moved to Los Angeles when all the boys were dressed like girls and trying to sound like Poison, and I show up, you know, like nobody wanted to play with me. You know, I was like, that dude's never going to get a record deal, but I did, you know. And I was able to put together a band with some other guys from Austin and some guys I knew from the punk scene and do something that I really liked. And we managed to get signed. And I'm dealing, you know, well, about a month after I move into Hollywood, I meet this girl, this beautiful little goth girl. who's dealing the best crystal meth I have ever seen in my life. And it was love. We always say the first day we met, we stayed up for a week, you know, that day, you know. So it's like, you know, it was love at first 7 day run, you know. And you know, I mean, she told me, you don't want any part of me, but I didn't believe her. I should have. But I had been doing that biker crank, that, oh my God, my head's going to die. You know, this was actually crystal meth. It was insane. And I've got a major label record deal, and I'm writing all the songs for the band, and I'm doing all the business, and I'm creating the artwork, and I'm doing my thing. And we're getting ready to go on tour. First record just came out. The single's all over. The video's all over MTV. I'm leaving in 2 days to go on tour, and the cook that I'm partners with, like you do, the DEA comes through his front door. And his girlfriend calls me while they're there. I'm like, wrong number, you know. And I sat down with my girlfriend. I said, look, we had this conversation. I think the conversation was about not doing drugs anymore. Because the gist of it was, dudes like me don't get this opportunity, not ever. I can count on one hand the number of fat dudes that got record deals, you know, and I don't want to fuck this up. And I think we thought we were talking about quitting drugs now that we weren't going to be selling speed anymore. And then I climbed in a tour bus 2 days later and began to drink a fifth of vodka and a case of beer and do as much blow as I could get people to give me. And within a week, she was strung out on heroin because we were way past stopping and we had no idea. So the first tour was insane. The band is continuing to get to do better. The second video gets played some. We're out opening arenas for Lynyrd Skynyrd and the Cult and stuff. But when I get back home, I'm paying for the heroin, so I'm going to do some. I had never really done it but once. And I've been up for 8 years. I needed a nap. It seemed like a good idea. And for the next 3 years, what my life looked like was I would climb on a tour bus. I would go to a doctor in L.A. that everybody in bands went to, and he would write me a prescription for whatever so I could climb on a bus and kick during the first week on the road and drink like an insane person and do whatever drugs I could get because there was no way to get heroin on tour. And then I'd come back and mask the DTs going straight back into dope. And as long as you were making money for people, nobody said anything. I was also on the same label as Nirvana, and when that record came out, we were in the middle of trying to make our third record, and everybody at the record label was staring at that record cover trying to figure out how to take credit for it. They didn't want to hear us anymore. Like, you know, we weren't like all those hair metal bands, but we may as well have been, you know, because that was all just over. So the band just made a conscious decision to move on, do something different. I got a job managing production for a fashion accessories designer, you know, like you do. It's L.A., and oddly enough, he was sober at the time, and I was completely strung out. And I worked for him running his facility for about 9 months and realized that he was paying me well enough to afford to stay strung out forever. And that scared me to death because it's funny because I had a lot of baggage around God and all the rest of that when I got into recovery. But I had a motto that I lived by, and that motto was, I don't pray for parking spaces. And what that means is I take care of business, and good stuff happens to me that I don't even know I need. And I knew within a week of starting on heroin that that deal was off. It was over, and I wasn't wrong. And so at about after working for this guy for 9 months, I came home. I'm still living with the same girl. She's not speaking to me because I won't pay for her dope anymore. And I tell her I'm leaving. I'm leaving L.A. I don't think I can get – nobody I knew was sober. It turns out that's not true. I knew four guys that were sober in 1994, but I hadn't seen them. I thought they were dead or in jail. You know, there wasn't any recovery in the music world at that point in time. So I sold half of everything I owned and bought a van and put the other half of everything I owned in the van. And she made up with me at the last minute because she didn't want to be left alone. And we climbed in that van with our cats and all our bullshit that we should have just abandoned and headed to Texas. It took 5 days to get here because heroin is not a good cross-country drug. Like, drive 3 hours, drool 3 hours, you know, whatever. So we got here, And we brought a bunch of pills and we kicked during the trip for the most part. And we landed at my dad's house. And I won't say we were sober because we might have been drinking, but my dad didn't really drink. And we didn't, you know, we're stuck way out in North Austin. And we didn't do any dope for 3 weeks. And 3 weeks after we got here, my girlfriend had a psychotic episode. And we had to call EMS. And they kept asking us, what is she on? What is she on? And what she was on was untreated malady. She had a break with reality because of staying in her own mind and in her own skin wasn't doable. And once she got out of the psych ward, we brushed off our Spanish. We head to Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, like you do in any city you go to, and start asking around, and we found dope. I mean, I've done that on tour in cities I wasn't even playing in. We just pull off. Where's Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard? We'll drive over there, find some dope, you know. But once moving didn't fix anything. I mean, I thought surely I can go to Texas. There won't be heroin there. I never had done it. I hadn't done it here. I didn't know, you know. Like, and I came here. But once moving didn't help, all bets were off. You know, I'm essentially a nice boy from a good family. But I didn't care if I lived or died. So I didn't care if you lived or died. I became willing to do things I still can't wrap my head around, that you can't make amends for. And my life just, that's all it is. And people talk about the drugs stopped working. They didn't stop working. They stopped doing what I needed them to do. And by the time I got enough heroin in my system to feel any relief, I was in respiratory arrest over and over and over. And I spent every day the last 2 years I was using trying to find a way not to use. I can't count how many times. I put myself on methadone, and I tried to detox myself, and they wouldn't reduce my dose, and they wouldn't tell me they weren't reducing my dose. There's no incentive to get me clean at all there. And I tried everything I could think of. And I know that I was dead 4 times because the ambulance came that many times. You know, other times my heart probably stopped and started itself again. I don't know. And what finally happened... This is one of those, like, I don't know that I believe in a God that loves me, but every once in a while I go, right? Too many coincidences in a row. So since I'm a little kid, it's hard to imagine now, but since I'm a little kid, I'm fascinated with music and there's no information. Like, you got the record cover, you got, like, Circus Magazine and Rolling Stone and nothing. And if the band comes and they don't come to Austin because it's a small town, you can get to see them play. So anytime there's anything on TV with music on, Sonny and Cher variety show, don't care, I'm watching it, it's music. So one day, I'm sitting in my room, and I'm I'm still trying to stay connected to my dad, and we go target shooting. He's getting old, and I'm putting a sight on a target pistol for him, and my dealer shows up. And I find myself sitting at my desk with a gun in one hand and a syringe in the other one, trying to decide which one to use. And it wasn't that thing that I assume we all do, I did, where I'm going, I don't think I'm going to help a kid. It wasn't that. It was just calmly, today or forever, what's it going to be? And for just a minute, I swear to God, I was at the other side of the room looking at my own back, saying, how the fuck did those get to be my only choices? I used to have a life. I got to do amazing stuff, and now that's it? There has to be something else. And I have no idea what it is. And then later that day, and I always joke, I don't know how much later because I didn't use the gun. sometime that evening, I'm channel surfing. And I run across this episode of 2020, the news magazine. And they're doing a feature about this jazz saxophone player. So I'm watching it, and they're going, yeah, and he played with all the greats in the 50s and the 60s, and then they go, and he was a heroin addict for 30 years. And I go, well, that's a weird thing to include. But it turns out the story's not about his music career. It's about the fact that this guy is now 10 years sober, and he's just started an organization completely funded by the Grammys whose sole purpose is to pay for people like me to get treatment. You know, and I had been to about half a dozen AA meetings during the year or so before this point. And I would tell them I was suffering, and they never told me about this place. They just went, just don't drink no matter what. And I fucked off and went to dinner and left me struggling. you know. But I saw this thing on TV and went, oh my God, that's my shot. So as soon as the show was over, I ran into my bedroom and I jumped on my computer and I pulled up their website, and 5.5 minutes later, it actually loaded because this is dial-up and they had one photo. It's like, right, fucking the AOL waiting room of hell. But I got their phone number, you know, and I would love to say that I became willing, and it's, but I had just enrolled in school because what I needed was structure and a job, and school was starting in 27 days, and they wanted me to go away for 30, and I said, can I leave 3 days early to start school on time? And they said, call us when you really want to go. I went, okay. So I hung out for a month and went to school for about a week. I went, I'm ready to go, sir. And then so they put me in touch with a treatment center out in the hill country. Then I got the second gift that I received on the way to getting sober. When I called that treatment center, they said, oh, you're on methadone? We can't take you on methadone. You should just stop taking that methadone, and we'll see you in 6 weeks. And what they were saying, without being able to say it out loud for liability reasons, was that they could deal with a heroin detox, but they couldn't. I'd be so sick on the methadone, I'd get nothing out of the program. And they were right. And so I had to go back to using full time with no net and no. If today's the day the dude sleeps, we're in trouble, you know. And I got to see just how ugly my life was. And I had to keep doing the things I needed to get the money I needed that I was so desperately trying to stop having to do. And it really made me, I was yearning to get somewhere. And then my ex, well, ex, on again, off again, we kept breaking up with each other because we were dying together. And then we would run into each other in the same parking lot, you know, and how that goes. And she gave me the third gift that I received. She said, you need to think about why you're going. Because if you go for the wrong reason and it doesn't work, I'm afraid you're going to stay dead next time. And I went, oh, okay, why am I going? And it took me a minute. But eventually, before I got to treatment, I realized that I was not going because I kept overdosing. And I wasn't going because my life was a shit show. And I wasn't going because I had so much trouble with the law. And I wasn't going because everybody who loved me wouldn't have anything to do with me. Those weren't the reasons I was going. The reasons I was going was because I couldn't pay my cable bill and go to the grocery store without a level of pharmaceutical help usually used for amputations on the battlefield. You know, like I don't know how to function without this drug, and there has to be a way because people do. I see them, you know, and I don't know what that is. And I'm grateful for that because a lot of my attempts at sobriety and a lot of the attempts at sobriety that I have watched people do over the years have really been attempts at manageability. Like they say they want, I said I wanted to be sober, but once the warrants were paid and the electric was back on, I got high again. So what I wanted was a manageability. What my action shows that what I wanted was some manageability back. But by the time I got to treatment, what I wanted more than anything on God's gray earth was to find a way to be able to breathe in and out all day without needing heroin. And then I landed there. And I didn't know 12 steps were going to be part of it, which was awesome. I always say that because I didn't have a chance to work up a good argument before I got there. You know, it freaked me out. I always talk about my first... I staggered up about 3 days into the detox. I staggered up into what was my first 12-step thing on campus. And I'm all fuzzed up on detox meds and sitting in this room full of people. And somebody starts talking about God and my head clears up for an instant. And I go, oh, no. And then that's all I remember. Laying, shaking in the detox unit thinking I'm at church camp, you know. And I, you know, once again, treatment was like middle school. And I was in an expensive treatment center on a charity bed. Most of the people that were in treatment with me still had nice skin and all their teeth, you know. And I show up. I got a white button down. I don't know where it came from. And there's blood all over the arms. Like, but there's a guy that works there named Ray. He's an old biker, old speed cook. And Ray's story and mine tells me his story, and his story and mine are very similar. And he helps me understand powerlessness. He helps me understand addiction. You know, by telling me his story and helping me look at my own. Like one of the things he did for me that I do with sponsees is he told me his story first. And then when he asked me to tell him my story, I organized it the same way he did without even knowing I was doing that. And it helped me get my own story in a shape that I could go, son of a bitch. You know, maybe I am. Because I'd spent a year arguing about why I needed to stop drinking beer. And I wasn't even drinking beer. I hadn't had a beer in 2 years because I read an article that said alcohol washed heroin out of your bloodstream faster. So I stopped drinking. I'm trying to be all I can be. Fuck. You know. Well, I'm not stupid. Well, not always. But so I'm, you know, I hear a lot of people say they did the first step when they were out there. I did a lot of research, but I had no idea what the truth was about addiction. I had no idea what powerlessness really meant. I had no idea what unmanageability was. You know, I thought unmanageability was the chaos in my life. And it was pointed out to me, no, this, we're talking about your inability to stop and stay stopped. That trick of the mind, the mental obsession that convinces you somehow it's going to be different or that you don't even care. You know, and by being able to talk with this guy who didn't have anything to sell me, he didn't care if he ever saw me again. He was just sharing what he had learned. And I was able to see my truth in it. And he was even able to help me understand why it was never going to be safe for me to, like, smoke weed, which I stopped in 1980 because that was making me stupid, and or drink alcohol. I couldn't do it. It was not safe. And then I spent 2 weeks arguing about whether or not God existed with the people in a mental hospital because, I mean, the big book says God either is or he isn't. I figured we should let people know. And I talk about this all the time, that I was terrified at this point. Because I believed that the 12 steps work. Even that early in the game, I believed the 12 steps would keep someone sober. But I was terrified that in order for it to work, I was going to have to come to believe in something that I knew I was never going to believe. You know, all this God business, never going to believe it. Still don't. You know, I was terrified that I was going to have to become a member of some church that I was lying about what I believed in order to go there. And I didn't think it would work if I was lying. But I spent 2 weeks arguing about whether the second, and what, you know, what the hell the second and third step meant, and then went, fuck that, and started writing a fourth step, because everybody at the treatment center had relapsed without doing their fourth step, and nobody was paying for me to come back. So whatever that is, I got to get on with it. Apparently that's good enough. You know, yeah, whatever, fuck it, fourth step. You know, if you're in the beginning of this stuff, don't let your disease get you hung up on trying to understand shit. It's not about understanding. The only way to understand something is with experience. You can't understand, like my first sponsor would go, you can be fascinated by skydiving and you can read books about skydiving and learn to fold parachutes and hang out at the goddamn airport. But until you jump out of the plane, you don't know a goddamn thing about skydiving. You know, then you can talk with some authority when you hit the ground. But I want to understand the things before I do them. But the only way to understand anything is to do it and then turn around and see what just happened. And I was encouraged to do that. Stop trying to figure this shit out and start doing it and examining your experience. And that became the model for my recovery. Action, experience, examination. Period. And I was able to fall in with some guys who also believed that way. Well, it wasn't a program about belief and faith at all. It was a program about action, experience, and examination. And I got out of treatment, and I had trouble finding my people. I went to a lot of meetings, eight or ten meetings in the first week I was out, and they're all full of old fucking contractors and old hippies, and where are my people? Where are the tattooed punk rock loony junk? They were all still strung out on Red River, going, why did Chris go to rehab? But on the sixth or seventh day I was out of treatment, on my way to rehab, the guy who drove me down there told me about this new meeting. And I swear to God, he told me that it was at this outlaw country dude's house. And I'm going, I can't go to his house. But it wasn't at his house. He was one of the guys that started it, and it was at this coffee shop. And I went, and I walked into this meeting. There's about 10 or 15 guys here. It's a men's meeting at noon on a Saturday. And there was this guy in that meeting, John. I'd known John since I was 18 and he was 19. He used to play in one of the bands that my band played with back in the early 80s. In fact, in the mid-80s, his band and my band played gigs together at the Continental Club, and we would draw straws to see who played first and who played last, because whoever played last was going to be way too drunk to play their own songs. Like one time, our two bands and this third band called Doctor's Mob ran up a nearly a $200 bar tab on 75-cent beer. You know, I was dealing meth at the time, so, but still, you know, between 14 guys, that's pretty good. And when I was in Los Angeles, John was also in L.A. playing guitar for a guy that was on the same label as me, and I would see him at the record company, and he didn't look happy. And then I came walking into this meeting, and there's John laughing and joking with a bunch of people who I don't know. And I know he's still playing music. And he had what I wanted, so he became my sponsor. You know, he was sober, he seemed happy about it, and he was still playing music. He became my sponsor. He hauled me through the rest of the steps. I was done with all 12 steps before I hit 60 days. I encourage you to do the same. Start over again. The more times you do it, the more experience you have, the better you understand what the hell's happening. I remember going to him at about 120 days sober. I'm done with the worst of my amends. I'm still trying to have to find some folks and figure out how the hell I'm ever, you know, I owe the IRS $90,000. That was going to take a minute, you know. But I remember going to my sponsor right around 120 days sober and going, dude, I think the promises are happening. Like, I think I got it. I think it's happening. And he looked at me and went, no. And I don't know why that didn't piss me off, but it didn't. And what he said was, dude, you are better than you have been in 20 years easily. And you are still so far from anything I would call good, you freak me out every time I see you. You know? And I went, it gets better than this? And he's going, oh, please don't stop here. Please don't stop at just not hurting. That's great for a minute, but I promise it won't be enough. And so I had to get busy and keep working. And at 6 months sober, I got super weird and itchy. And I was doing as much as a guy with 6 months could do, but I wasn't carrying the message to anybody. And so I had to start finding ways, not to sponsor, I wasn't ready for that yet, but to start being of service. And not just setting up chairs and stuff, but actually carrying a message, just not as an official sponsor. Like he would send me with one of his new sponsees. I got a new guy. He's supposed to be doing the second step. Go talk to him. That'll freak him out. You know. My sponsor lost $10 when I got 90 days. I'm not even joking. So he was a practical guy. But that helped carry me through that year. And I understand now that getting through a year of sobriety is really only the second hurdle in recovery. The first hurdle is getting through the 12 steps. Do that as fast as you can. Start over. The second one's getting through a year, because once I've been sober a year, I have seen 95% of everything life's ever going to do and stayed sober at least once. One Christmas, one New Year's Eve, one 4th of July, 12 cable bills, 52 fucking Wednesday afternoons. I mean, the second year of sobriety is mostly about starting to freak out and go, oh, I've already done this, you know, and because I have experience, once again. And then at 2 years sober, I realized that I had gone about setting up a quiet life. Because that's what everybody around me was doing, was setting up a quiet life. But I never wanted a quiet fucking life. And my friends didn't either. And what they were doing was, they would set up these nice quiet lives with a little job and their little apartment. And then they would like stand up and like sleep with somebody's boyfriend or girlfriend and just light themselves on fire just to have something to do for entertainment. Then they'd use the steps like a fire extinguisher for 2 or 3 months. And it occurred to me that, like, and I wasn't an exception, you know. I had to stop going to my home group for a while, you know. It's really only a 12-step program for, if you included the 13th, because there was no helping anybody for the first year. But I had this spiritual awakening at about 14 months sober at the treatment center I went to, you know, where I'd been working the steps and having these experiences. And it's my belief that a spiritual awakening for most people is the cumulative effect of a lot of small spiritual experiences that I gain by doing the steps. And I hit this place at 14 months sober where I'm standing in this field at a reunion at the treatment center with 500 or 600 people. And I'm looking around the circle and it occurs to me that if even half of the people in the circle were as miserable and sane as I was when I went to this treatment center, this is a fucking miracle. And at that moment, that word had substance for the first time. maybe like 600 crackheads and junkies and alcoholics fully clothed and in their right minds enjoying a day outside in Kerrville on purpose, you know. And at that moment, I started getting real serious about sponsorship. And then when 2 years comes along, I realize I'm creating this chaos in my life. And I begin to wonder what it would look like to create positive chaos. To go take on a challenge on purpose that's just as hard as the hole I have to climb out of, but my life is better because of it. And when I got out of rehab, I got a job. The last job I had before crime was installing for Time Warner. You know, they fired me after about 6 weeks because I kept getting complaints that basically boiled down to, you sent a very large, very sweaty, very angry, bald guy to my house. So, at least I'm not angry anymore. So after I got sober, I had no job skills. You know, I was good at stuff that nobody would pay me to do or that I was never going to be comfortable doing sober. So I started working for Time Warner again. And it paid really, really well. It took no advantage of any of my abilities. And so at 2 years sober, I went, I got to go get some job skills. So I went back to school. Turned out at the time, and I think it's still true, that if you have a psychiatric diagnosis, a medical psychiatric diagnosis, and you've been to inpatient treatment, the state of Texas qualifies you as handicapped and will pay for job training. Yeah, I think that's still true. They paid for me to go to a 2-year program at ACC to become a web developer, and that's what I did. You know, which was good because right around the time I finished the training, the company I was working for went out of business and didn't tell anybody. And I had no job skills again. And I ended up spending the next 10 or 12 years being a freelance web developer and commercial artist and doing pretty well at it. Then the next thing I realized was I wanted a relationship. And I had no idea how to put that together. You know, people say my picker was broken, but I didn't think I got to pick, honestly. You know, I've been a touring musician. I've slept with hundreds of people, and I have no problem at all holding the idea in my head that women are never going to be interested in a dude like me. And so anybody that showed any interest, I would have, that's all I get. So I got a new sponsor because he had a relationship that looked like the one I wanted, and he walked me through this process. It took about 2 years, you know, of doing step work and learning to stop be so dependent on the people around me and the way things are going for my well-being and start to depend on a higher power so that I could learn how to show up in a relationship and learn how to date without sleeping with anybody. I know, weird. All of my long-term relationships, I was a serial monogamous for years, and all of my long-term relationships were one-night stands that lasted 2 years. We go home after the gig, we sleep together, I learn your last name the next day, you move in 3 weeks later, a month after that we figure out if we like each other, and then a year and a half later it all falls apart. You know, I didn't know any other way, you know. But I had to write this ideal. What am I really looking for? You know, we talk about progress, not perfection, but if I don't know what perfection looks like, how can I tell if I'm picking better partners? So I wrote down what I was looking for, and every time I'd meet anybody, I'd go, I wonder how much of this she is, and the first answer is, I don't even know her last name. You know, I better go on some dates with her and figure out who she is. And it turns out if I'm not sleeping with them and they're not really what I'm looking for, I can just stop and still be friends. So I did that. It was weird. I did a lot of inventory. And then my wife, who I'd known for 4 years, we both remember the moment we met. Something happened for both of us. And then something else happened right on the heels of it, which were both of us were instantly a little sad that that person would never be interested in us because we came from different worlds. But we remained friends for 4 years. And I'm not good at friendships. I don't know how to do friendships. I'm really bad at it. So I started like having to call people and try and maintain friendships. And she was one of the people I wasn't seeing her by accident anymore. So we'd go have dinner once a month or something just as friends. And then one day I realized I was on my way to her house and I didn't want to be her friend anymore. And if I continued to show up as a friend, I was lying. So I did the scariest thing I ever did. I told her I didn't want to just be friends. She thought it meant I didn't want to hang out with this single mom anymore. I went, no, I want to date you. At that point, there was literally 3 minutes of radio silence while she sat perfectly still doing fear inventory in her head. She's got more time than me. And then she said, okay. You know, we've been married 12 years. We've never had a fight, not one. Not because we're awesome, but because we both know how to do inventory. And we know that you can't argue with a sick person. And if somebody does something asinine, it's because they're spiritually unfit, not because they're being mean to you. You know, and is this a one-off thing or does this need to be addressed? And if it's happening over and over, it needs to be addressed, but not during the incident. you know, we both work a good program. I mean, I kid her all the time that she has the two qualities I like best in a woman, poor eyesight and bad judge of character. But the truth is, both of us took a serious step up when we started dating each other. And both of our programs have really rocketed forward because we would make anybody else nuts, because we both really like to talk about spirituality and how this works. And then in 2015, I was having some conversations with people outside the 12-step world, spiritual Buddhist monk, Hindu priest, guy from the Episcopal Church, and they kept talking about the other side of one of them was talking about the other side of humility. And what he meant by that is, we use humility to mean smaller, mean right size. Stop doing God's job, start trying to do yours. But there's another piece to humility, because right size also means that every one of us is born with some sort of a talent. Every one of you has something that's easy for you that's not easy for other people. You know, and at some point it becomes my responsibility to start developing that talent for myself and the world. And I've been told when I talk about spirituality since early in my recovery that I do it in a way that's simpler and more direct, and I have no idea what to do with that when people tell me that. If you tell me my band is good, I'll tell you thank you, because I worked very hard to make that good. But this just happened. So the guys I were talking goes, well, apparently that's a talent. And you got to figure out what to do with that. And so I came home, and I began to sort of meditate and pray on what it might look like, and 2 weeks later I got offered this job, which is perfect. You know? I can't even look at you people. I can't remember the last time I cried because I was sad, but my heart gets shattered looking at you people with happiness. And I'll finish with this. I'm not special. I'm not. I just really fucking do what it says to do all the fucking time. Like all the time. You know, and not because I'm a good guy, because some are sicker than others, and buddy, I got it. Like, I will turn into an asshole when the wind changes direction if I'm not careful. And I will do anything to never go, not just to go back to drugs and alcohol, but I'll do anything not to be that man I turned into again. Anything. Even inventory. Even calling my sponsor. Any of it. You know, if you want what I have, you can have it, but you have to do what I do. You have to be careful out there, because half the people that are staying sober in meetings aren't doing fuck all. I think a third of the people who are staying sober in meetings aren't even alcoholics and addicts. I mean, think about it. 2018 America, where are you going to find a community that welcomes you even though they don't know you, and they will listen to your bullshit and give you free coffee? Not even church a lot of times. If you go in AA, you go, we're glad you're here. All you got to do is go, I'm an alcoholic. You know? There's a lot of hard drinkers in AA meetings and hard users that turn up in 12-step meetings, but they're not like me. And they can say, take it easy. Easy does it. Slow down. Work the steps slowly. Let's spend 3 weeks on step six instead of 2 minutes on them. You know, like, they'll kill me. You know, that's what happened to me at about 2 years sober. I was looking at these people and going, like, if I keep doing what they're doing, I'm going to get high. Because I'm getting more and more uncomfortable. I'm like a cat on a hot tin roof. If it keeps getting hotter, I'm fixing to jump. You know, but you can have what I have. You can. You know, time is a component of spiritual growth. You have to take an action to gain the experience over and over and over and over again. But like, I saw a guy when I was about a year sober get a 20-year chip. He's the same age as me. Sobered up at 20. And he said something that was profound. I mean, what he said was, I can't imagine why I would ever stop living life this way, because it's so satisfactory now that it's muscle memory. I know it's clumsy in the beginning. I know you want to beat yourself up and not do it, and you feel stupid and awkward, but just keep going. You know, just keep going. I mean, I would say don't stop before the miracle, but I think for most of you, the miracle already happened because you're not jonesing today. Don't stop till you realize the miracle already happened. And then just keep going, because there's more miracles. I'm living proof of that. You know, my life is going to change in unrecognizable ways over the next year. I'm having gastric sleeve surgery in 2 weeks. I'm going to lose 120-something pounds this year. It's fucking terrifying. I still confuse the light in the refrigerator and the sunlight of the spirit on a pretty regular basis. So, but if I want to do the things I need to do, I want to live to be old. You know, I figured at 45 years old, I finally figured out how to fucking live. I would like for that to be the middle. You know, and there's not a lot of 300-pound 70-year-olds, and them that are alive are crippled. So I got to do some shit. You know, it's not over. I got step work to do. I got trusting the power, whatever it may be, and getting on with it. And so do you. But it's an unbelievable journey. There's so much more joy. Even the miserable days, there's hope. That's the difference. Even on the times, and I've been through some awful physical stuff in the last year or so, and it gets pretty fucking dark, and it's really hard to see the sunlight of the spirit for all the darkness in my body. But hope never left. And that's the difference. Thanks, guys.